From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them.
Obama's tax deal, triumph or betrayal, the latest on WikiLeaks, plus is start, stopped, and the war on Prince Charles. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator in the political center. Robert Scheer is on the left in Santa Monica. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. Ariana Huffington from the independent progressive blogosphere out in L.A. This is a big, big week. The news of Obama's tax cut compromise with the Republicans setting off a firestorm in Washington. I think everybody who's listening knows the basic contours. Why don't we go around the horn, get things on the table? Robert Scheer, betrayal, triumph, what do you make of it?
Well, I'll quote that well-known centrist, Matt Miller, who on a previous show said that if Obama sells out on tax cuts for the wealthiest, then it will be a betrayal. I don't know if you use that exact word, but it seems to me that's the reasonable position to take. And then one has to question if he will cave at a time when we are worried about the spiraling debt, when we're wondering about how to pay for these things, at a time when we have made the banks and the wealthiest people whole while unemployment is so high and the middle class is hurting so much. If Obama can't stick to the point he campaigned on of getting rid of the Bush tax break for the richest as a start on bringing down debts, then he has joined their camp, and there is no room to distinguish between his position and the Republicans, and you have to wonder what the election was all about.
Although, Tony, I want to bring you into this, but Charles Krauthammer, Bob, I don't know if you saw the piece that he wrote on Friday in the Washington Post.
I was quoting Matt Miller, not Krauthammer.
I appreciate that, Bob. But, Tony, you must have seen this morning. I'd be curious. He thinks that Obama swindled the GOP and Democrats are too idiotic to realize how he was able to get a second stimulus he never could have gotten by that name just by giving them tax cuts for the rich, Tony. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I usually agree with everything that Charles writes, or 90% of it. I don't agree with this. First of all, I don't think that it is, in an economic sense, much of a stimulus, because all it is doing is maintaining the same tax level. I don't understand how that stimulates. If we do let the taxes go up, that will be a contraction. You know, there is some stimulus. There's some other smaller taxes. There's the Social Security. There's to the extent that the unemployment extension is a stimulus. Those stimuluses. But that's, a few hundred billion of the 900 billion. So I disagree with the characterization of the size of it. I also disagree with Charles that this is somehow a swindle of the Republicans. I think the Republicans, we know they've been wanting to perpetuate the Bush tax cuts. They've been talking about it for 9 years, and they got what they wanted for 2 years. They'd like to have it forever, but there is no forever. Every Congress can change the law. I think the president has probably done himself a fair amount of political good. Doesn't hurt to have the left screaming at him. Makes him look like he's closer to the center. I don't know. Now, he's made a strange statement on Thursday and Friday, one of them on NPR, I believe, where he said that he completely thinks that the tax cut over $250,000 won't create any jobs, but this package overall will create millions of jobs. So it's a curious economic analysis. And of course, he's found Republicans defending him this week, which is, I think, for him right now, good news politically.
Ariana, what do you make of it?
You know what? Only in Washington, where I am at the moment, do people think that it will make any difference in 2012 whether Charles Krauthammer defended him or Ed Schultz opposed him. The only thing that will matter is, do people have jobs? Do they have the prospect of jobs? Are they being thrown out of their homes? And there is nothing in this bill that's going to make it more likely that people will have jobs, that the economy will recover. And that's really the main problem with this bill. We'll increase the deficit, which will make it more likely that Republicans will want to extract their pound of flesh in more spending cuts down the road. And if this is a backdoor stimulus, it's a really bad one.
You know, I just had one thought.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say that half of what Ariane says is right. It will encourage Republicans to push for spending cuts down the line. But even the deficit commission doesn't argue that we shouldn't be stimulating the economy now. They simply say that in a few years we need to have enacted serious reductions in deficits. So there's no inconsistency with stimulating an economy that's flat and preparing for structural reductions in our spending and revenue problems.
Well, let me share my thoughts on this, which is I'm morally outraged, and I'll explain why in a second by this. But I do think it was a de facto backdoor stimulus that he probably couldn't have gotten any other way. And I don't think it's the most effective stimulus, because I agree with – I didn't hear the NPR thing today, Tony, but I think I agree. If Obama's economic analysis is cockeyed, I agree with it totally, which is the tax cuts for the top 2% won't help create jobs. But a lot of the other stuff, the analysis I've read, says the CBO thinks it's going to raise GDP 1 point and maybe cut a point or a point and a half off unemployment. So fine. I guess the thing that most troubles me, and maybe I'm the only one, I feel like I'm becoming a bore on this, but the idea that at a time of war we are prioritizing keeping taxes low for the best off 2% in our society, I think is just wrong. It's morally wrong. Never before in U.S. history have we cut taxes on wealthy people during a time of war. And it's only in this surreal world we have today that we can have this whole debate as if it was only an economic debate, not a debate about how to finance what we're doing as a country. And Republicans feel safe just sticking to their talking points. I've been doing this on TV stuff lately. And when you throw in the argument against conservatives saying, isn't it wrong to keep taxes low on wealthy people and borrow from China to finance $150 billion a year in Iraq and Afghanistan and ask our kids to pay for it? I don't know. Tony, what do you make of that? Doesn't that bother you?
No. For one thing, we're not lowering taxes. We're keeping the same level. I think we need to reduce the deficit overwhelmingly on the spending side. I think high taxes are – I mean, you know the conservative free market formula, the Reaganite formula. That's one I find persuasive.
But not during a time of war. Not during the time of war. Go ahead.
Can I intervene for a second?
We're not spending that much on the war, $200 billion a year. I mean, out of everything we're spending.
This isn't
World War II. This is not the Civil War. This is not a war that is consuming large quantities of American wealth relative to the total size of our economy. It is, in absolute numbers, they're huge. But in relative numbers, they're smaller than I think the Vietnam War was a drag on the
economy.
With all respect, I find that argument appalling, Bob.
With all respect, can I get in here?
You mean Tony. You don't mean Bob.
That was not my argument.
Tommy.
That was Tony. Let me make
that
my point.
I was handing the microphone to Bob and calling Tony appalling, let me be clear.
All right. Let me just
his argument. It's not an ad hominem appalling.
Okay. First of all, Tony is right, even though I oppose both the Afghan and Iraq war. That is not the major source of military spending. What happened was in the so-called war on terror, the cuts that the first President Bush had made in military spending, and this was when Cheney was his Secretary of Defense. They were going to cut the military budget by a third. Instead, they used the 9/11 attack as an excuse to ramping up to higher than Cold War levels on a per capita basis, certainly in absolute dollars, but even on a per capita basis, they reached the highest point of the Cold War. So we're now spending, in effect, $1 trillion a year. The actual hot wars that we're fighting are an excuse for keeping up all the big-ticket items that John McCain was once against and so forth. And Sarah Palin endorsed in the Wall Street Journal this Friday, no, we can't touch any of that. So it is quite true that we're spending an enormous amount on the military, but it's way beyond what is needed for these rather primitive military wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Secondly, in terms of the tax stimulus, we should separate. Obviously, unemployment insurance should have been extended. Obviously, that has a high multiplier effect. You give people money who are out of work, they're going to spend all of it, and they're going to spend it in ways that create jobs. That is not true with tax cut for the super rich. These people don't hold back their spending because they are short of money. They buy whatever they want. And so it's pushing on a string to give those people a break. But in terms of controlling the debt, and this is where where I think Obama dropped the ball. The challenge to the banks should have been, to the Republicans should have been, hey, you created this mess. We are in this enormous debt now because of the mess you created. We spent a lot of money, trillions, through the Fed and everything else, bailing you out, making you whole. And now you're blackmailing us into saying that we have to give you a cut or you won't create jobs. That is really the argument. The banking lobby is saying all the big corporations and everything are holding back money, not creating jobs because they're afraid of there won't be a continuation of the tax cut. This is an absurd argument. And if we simply cannot cut the debt, if we don't do those two things, cut military spending and make the taxes more progressive and cut the brakes for the super rich, who are the cause of our indebtedness at this time.
One thing, Ariana, I don't understand, and then take it where you will, is why I agree that I think Obama had to cut a deal by December 31st. I don't think it was that this could go into next year and taxes would go up mostly on lower income Americans, which would have been a bad thing and during a recession. But he didn't have to make his deal on December 6th or 7th. He could have made it on December 28th. And I don't understand why he didn't decide to mount, if he believes, which I think the polls showed, that the public was with him, basically, and thinking the tax cut should be extended for those under 250, but not for those over 250. Why didn't he hit the road? Why didn't he challenge the Senate Republicans to a televised debate on this one narrow issue and try and turn public opinion and really make a major case of it and then be in a position to cut a better deal 2 weeks from now?
Well, I completely agree with you. I think it was a definite communication failure as well as a policy failure. And on top of it was done in a way that it made the House, the Democrats in the House, feel that it was rammed down their throats. So now he has this really divided party. At a moment when having Charles Krauthammer on his side is not really going to help very much. But beyond that, I think, Matt, what you said is really important, that what the president did during the campaign and why there was such enormous enthusiasm for him has to do with the fact that he did bring moral arguments into the public debate. I mean, even before the debate, in fact, if you go back and read his amazing speech at the Call for Renewal rally in 2006, June 2006, you see that he's able to talk in those terms. Not every politician can, but he can. So what I find really stunning is that he has given up that ability that he has to connect us in a deeper way, to go beyond this policy debate, which you can lose if you're using phony math, as the Republicans often are.
Let me make a practical observation on behalf of the president. We are a week or two before Christmas. The reality is that is a terrible season for politicians to be communicating with the public because the public's busy Christmas shopping and cleaning up the house and getting ready for Christmas and going home early from work and going to parties. And so the president had to – how many times could he go out and talk and communicate? We've seen, because of the way that communications have changed in the last decade or so, that a president doesn't have the microphone that he had 10, 20, 30 years ago. And he only had 2 weeks to get the job done, and the Democrats weren't going to be happy whenever he gave it to them. So if I had been the president, I would have timed it about the way he did. He's going to have 2 weeks since he made the announcement, probably, before he's going to get passage. The Congress said they wanted to go home December 18th. You don't want to play a whole lot closer to the edge than that, because on January 1st, the whole thing, you know, suddenly people on unemployment don't get the unemployment and everybody starts having their taxes increased. So I think if any of us were actually president, you'd probably see the logic of the president's timing.
That's not unfair, Tony, though I'd still like to have seen him stretch it out to the maximum feasible length. But let me ask you quickly, because we're going to have to move on a sec, Tony. But on the politics of it, isn't this really echoes of sort of the Clinton post-94 triangulation? And isn't the White House pleased as punch that the Democrats, the liberals are erupting against him? And this is what the news coverage tends to be?
The second part is absolutely true. Obviously, having liberals screaming at Obama is perfect for him. As far as the triangulation, the president's rhetoric is so ambiguous. I mean, he calls Republicans hostage takers. When President Clinton agreed with our welfare bill and signed it into law in 96, after vetoing it twice in 95, he endorsed the policy because he understood it, or he believed, as we did, that it was a popular policy. So I don't know which way the president's going. He's sort of coming dragging and screaming into the center, and I don't know whether he's planning to stay there or whether this was just a brief detour from his traditional position on the left.
Let us know what you think about the. But let us know what you. Hold on, Bob. Let us know what you think about the tax cut deal that Obama's cut at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, the secret about WikiLeaks. More on Start and the mob and Prince Charles. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller, coming to you from Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia today. Robert Scheer, author of The Great American Stick-Up. Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times. Arianna Huffington of the ubiquitous Huffington Post, and author of Third World America. Bob, did you have a nano thought you were trying to add there?
Well, first of all, I'm the editor of the ubiquitous truthdig.com. But yes, I do have a nano thought. When Tony mentioned welfare reform and Clinton enthusiastically backing it after opposing it as evil, it seems to me that's the lesson here. Clinton went on to support the Telecommunications Act. He also went on to do the Financial Services Modernization Act, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which opened the door to all of these suspect derivatives that are the source of our misery. So I asked the question, you know, what is a liberal, forget a liberal, what is a rational person to do? We're supposed to cheer on a president who then opens the door to more greed, to more pain in the society. And, you know, when Tony celebrates this, there are 44 million Americans officially, according to the census, now living under the poverty line. That, as a percentage of the population, is the same as when Clinton came into office. So we have made no progress in that area, despite all the claims for that administration. So why? What is democracy about if we don't get to debate these questions? Why didn't the president draw the line and say, no, I want to extend unemployment insurance, try to defeat me on that. No, I won't give more money to the very wealthy that have caused this mess.
First, two quick points. One, most weeks you mention that I'm sort of joyous in the suffering of the masses, and I think rather I hope that everybody is well off, and we have different theories about how to get there. But we are having a chance to debate it. But the fact is the president asked the Democratic Congress before the election to bring the issue up, and they didn't want to bring it up, and now they want to bring it up 2 weeks before Christmas.
Well, we'll have to leave it there with that observation for this week. WikiLeaks, a lot of news this week. First, there was the kind of revolt of the anarchists on the web, the kind of denial of service attacks that took place against Visa and MasterCard, et cetera. On Friday, as we went to air, the U.S. Justice Department was talking about how they might be able to indict Julian Assange, and he's in custody now on these Swedish sex-related charges. Arianna, why don't I start with you? What do you make of where the WikiLeaks story has moved this week? What interests you?
Well, there are really three things that interest me. One is a battle that was inevitable, and that's the battle between traditional government secrecy as the default position and the transparency that's made more and more possible by the new technologies. And now the WikiLeaks revelations are simply accelerating that showdown. Then there's the question of all the revelations, especially the ones about Afghanistan, which simply confirm how disastrous our policies are there. And finally is the conflation of the character of Assange with the rightness or wrongness of WikiLeaks. I mean, Assange could be a saint or a rapist, which he's not, incidentally. I mean, these are some weird Swedish charges he's being jailed under. And that would still be irrelevant to what is happening with WikiLeaks and all the issues that are now at the forefront of the debate. And let's just say something about these charges. I mean, the guy is basically in jail because of a broken condom, which is kind of a new spin on the word WikiLeaks.
Is that now? Is that? And I hadn't followed that intricate detail, Tony. I want to get you into it. But so he's the law is something about a broken condom, and that qualifies as a crime or non-consensual
sex or
something.
Yes, there's some Swedish law that if the condom breaks and you go on despite your partner saying no, that's some kind of law that you're being charged. I'm not kind of minimizing the importance of that, but I think to call it rape is definitely not what it was.
That's going to be a hell of a trial, Tony.
I'm not sure we're going to get to that trial real quickly. If what we're hearing out of the American Justice Department is true, and it's too soon to tell it at this moment as we go to broadcast, we have wonderful extradition treaty with Britain, better than our treaty with Sweden, which is pretty good. It would not surprise me that if we are going to indict him, we may try to try him first in America for under the 1917 Espionage Act, where, by the way, intent is an element of the crime and will have to be proven, but his mental attitude and the words he's uttered publicly in regard to that will be evidence, either strong enough or not strong enough, to constitute a violation of the statute. And then maybe if there's still a sex charge, we'd send him to Sweden after that. But I'm not confident of that because I'm not confident that the Justice Department really is going to go ahead, but we're hearing rumors about it this last 24 hours.
Robert, what do you make of it all this week?
Well, it's interesting. This is on a day when we could be discussing the Chinese government refusing to let the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, who's in jail, accept it, and we can roundly condemn that totalitarian action. And yet we are sitting here almost chuckling about somebody facing espionage charges for having served the cause of a free press. This is the great free press issue of our time, the biggest one since the Pentagon Papers. And let's be very clear, what Assange did is no different in terms of the law than what the New York Times did in publishing these documents. He did not have classification. He had, as opposed to Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon case, who had worked at the RAND Corporation, was working there, had signed certain agreements. That was the basis of his prosecution. But there was no case in the Pentagon Papers, nor will there be now against the New York Times for publishing these documents. And if anybody involved in the theft of the documents, it would probably be somebody who had access. Assange did not have any access. All he did was obtain documents, just as the New York Times did. And the key thing here is that the documents have turned out to be incredibly valuable. By the way, none of them was stamped top secret. If they were that all fire and important, why weren't they? But the real issue here is that day after day, we get this news that somebody like Dianne Feinstein, who's head of the Intelligence Committee, she had this information all along when she voted for the Iraq War and the Afghan War. We didn't have it. Now she wants this guy persecuted, prosecuted under the Espionage Act. I'm all for the people who are trying to hack the system, and I think a great free speech battle for the Internet.
If I were Assange, I wouldn't rely too much on the Pentagon Papers, which was a prior restraint case. That was Nixon tried to stop it from being published. But five of the justices, in varying degrees of enthusiasm, suggested that an after-the-fact and violation of the Espionage Act might stand against a legitimate journalistic organization. Justice White, I think, put that in a footnote. I think it was a footnote. But so it's not clear at all that First Amendment rights trump espionage laws, even for a legitimate newspaper, and he is not one of those.
You mean after publication, you could still have been punished?
Yes,
Pentagon
Papers was prior restraint. Nixon wanted to stop the New York Times from publishing it, and that was the issue where prior restraint is almost never granted, and it wasn't granted to Nixon.
Let us know what you think about the latest WikiLeaks developments at kcrw.com/LRC. Just 2 minutes left. Just briefly, Tony, start us off. I know you've been following the debate over the START Treaty and the fact that it's not clear at this point whether it will be ratified. Tell us what.
Let me see. There's a backstory to the START Treaty passage, which I just recently learned about talking with some diplomats, and it's fascinating. This is, first of all, almost the entire Republican foreign policy establishment endorses START, so it's not a substantive question. The question is whether they're going to get it done or not. apparently Medvedev and Putin are on opposite sides of this. The election for president in 2012 in Russia, if we don't pass the START treaty, Putin's people believe that that will allow him to be able to beat Medvedev, and it is deeply in American interest that Medvedev gets reelected rather than Putin, because Medvedev is actually showing some signs of responsibility, and Putin, Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, Medvedev is the president, obviously is a very shrewd antagonist of ours. So that's sort of an important backstory to getting this done, and I think getting it done this year, if at all possible.
Bob, just briefly, is this going to happen, and shouldn't it?
Well, it should happen if there would be any sense on the part of the Republicans. This is what Richard Nixon wanted. It's what Dwight Eisenhower wanted. It's even what Ronald Reagan wanted at the end of his tenure, to make this a safer world. We have to have an understanding with people who have nuclear weapons, beginning with the Russians, about controlling them. And I think it's just vicious mischief to interfere with this. And
Ariana, we've got to ratify it. Ariana, we just got 30 seconds till we rant, but Prince Charles and Camilla, kind of the riot in London.
I'm so glad that Bob and Tony are getting the SALT treaty and I'm getting Prince Charles.
What's your take?
Some days your prince will come. Always got a condom.
You know,
Any brief thoughts on that?
My only brief thought is that it's amazing how people are demonstrating everywhere in Europe, but nobody's demonstrating here. Don't you find it fascinating? You know, France, Greece, England are all erupting, and we're just taking it.
Let us know what you think about the eruption deficit in the U.S. at kcrw.com/LRC. We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. About 20 seconds each. Robert Scheer, it is your soapbox.
Yes, I want to reiterate that Assange is one of the great heroes of our time. It's unconscionable for people not to support him at this time. And what's involved is the sacred principle of an informed public. And it was Thomas Jefferson who said, better a free press and no government than a government and no free press. And that's the issue here.
Tony Blankley.
I worry that Washington is on the brink of losing the capacity to practically get to solutions that neither side is 100% in favor of. I think we're going to get there on this tax bill. But if we can't do that on a regular basis, we can't govern ourselves and democracy will fail.
On that hopeful note, Ariana Huffington.
On that hopeful note, I want to endorse what my friend Tony Blankley said. And Tom Friedman actually put it rather well when he said that we are now only capable of producing suboptimal solutions to all our crises.
Well, I just want to ask folks to keep those names coming for better alternative names for the Radical Center that will solve all these problems. I'll announce the winners next week on the show. And I got to say, on the Prince Charles thing, it did remind me, when you watch the video of that and the pictures in the Friday papers, how fragile the social order is when people suddenly decide that, hey, maybe these guys shouldn't have this gig while my tuition is being jacked up from $4,800 to $15,000. Maybe we shouldn't be endowing these hereditary roles who can come in Rolls Royces and black tie and go to their parties. So it does make you realize again how fragile some of these social situations are. That's all the socializing we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer, Ariana Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek, with a big thanks to Raymond Jones at WHRO here in beautiful Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for another edition of Left, Right, and Center.
So if you like pajamas,
pajamas,
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we
know we need each other, so we better call the calling of home. Let's go.
You can podcast Left, Right, and Center, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog from our new media player at kcrw.com. Send questions or comments to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.